Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, the non-DOGE approved standard, both looking at various aspects of what else King Donald. No doubt most of you have seen his joking, haha, reference to himself as King when he announced his attempt of doubtful legality to cancel New York City's congestion pricing program, which charges drivers, despite the propaganda mostly affluent, $9 to enter Manhattan, funds that will be used to finance investment in our transit system. Can't have that. And then, of course, there was his joking, again with a ha-ha, citation of a quote wrongly or rightly attributed to Napoleon, saying, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." Cap C, cap L. What's he saving us from? Pronouns? So what exactly is Trump? Is he a fascist? Is he a new kind of neoliberal? To answer these and related questions, we'll hear from two guests familiar to Behind the News listeners, Anatole Levin and Quinn Slobodian. Anatole first. He is the director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, based in Washington. In the 1980s and 90s, Anatole covered the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and the wars in Afghanistan, Chechnya, and the Southern Caucasus for the Financial Times and the Times of London. We start by talking about the speech that Vice President J.D. Vance, a man who is very selective in his concerns about fair elections and freedom of expression, gave to the Munich Security Conference, in which he condemned Western Europe for not being open enough to the far right. It shocked the Europeans in the audience who wanted to be reassured that Trump isn't abandoning Ukraine, and they didn't hear that. Here's Anatole Levin with more. It's really wild to see J.D. Vance complaining about denying election results, threats to free speech, while Musk, the co-president, is prescribing prison for journalists who annoy him, and Trump won't let AP into the White House because they refuse his name for the Gulf of Mexico. What do you make of this extended denunciation of European speech practices coming from an administration whose record on this is really pretty disgraceful?
Certainly Vance, but probably, I mean, if you've also been listening to what Musk has been saying about Europe, the Trump administration in general has decided to line up alongside and bet on for the future the radical right parties in Europe. It's not totally accurate to say that Vance's speech was an attack on Europe. It was an attack on the existing European establishments. But of course, Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, Le Pen in France, and others absolutely loved this because, well, obviously it's what they've been saying. What this indicates is that the West is disintegrating. It's not exactly disappearing, but it's fracturing. But it's fracturing not just between the US and Europe, but within the US and within Europe. So you're going to have multiple ideas of the West all clashing and fighting with each other.
A lot of the criticisms of the speech I've seen come from people who really are enthusiasts for the Ukraine war and for a military buildup in Europe. That's not something that we would entirely approve of, is it?
Well, I think that's the problem, or a problem. I mean, there are many problems. I've just been writing a piece for The Nation in which I talk about the problem for liberals in America and in Europe. Having portrayed Trump as a fascist or would-be fascist, by the way, I mean, I think that's actually wrong, but we can talk about exactly what he is later. But having portrayed him as a fascist, well, fascists are not supposed to be peacemakers. It does put them in a very strange position to be arguing for more war, for more military engagement, when, you know, you have this US administration, which is now, you know, pushing for a deal. Pete Hegseth, there's a question about whether he should have said all these things and whether he was, you know, giving too much to the Russians in advance. But the fact of the matter is that what Hegseth said simply recognized realities. Ukraine is not going to be in NATO. We've been lying to the Ukrainians and to ourselves on this for a couple of decades now, almost. Ukraine is not going to reconquer its lost territories. There isn't going to be a US guarantee to a European force in Ukraine because that's NATO membership by another route. And in any case, Biden ruled out such a US guarantee to Ukraine. So, I mean, the Trump administration is a funny mixture. It's not one that's easy to pin down in classic ideological terms. What it clearly is a gang of capitalist oligarchs and some of the others providing populist cover for this. That is clear enough. Populist oligarchs looking to plunder the state. I mean, Musk would say that he wants to plunder the state, you know, for the good of this great mission of his to Mars and beyond. Others might have a different opinion of that.
It's funny that Vance was talking about free speech, and just Tuesday morning, the German police raided a meeting between Yanis Varoufakis, Francesca Albanese, and Amnesty International because they're going to discuss Palestine, Gaza. This outrage over free speech is very selective, but then, you know, there is something to complain about here.
Absolutely. But of course, Vance was only talking, as usual, about suppression of people he disagrees with. He didn't say anything about the suppression of pro-Palestinian protests, or indeed in Britain, of anti-climate change protesters. The point is that as politics becomes more polarized, but also as liberal establishments feel themselves to be coming under more and more pressure, many governments are becoming more authoritarian. And I think it's worth remembering, you know, that in recent decades, we've come to, you know, associate liberalism very much with ideas of free speech and free democracy, not guided democracy. That was not liberalism in the 19th century. Liberalism in the 19th century was all about liberal capitalist elites pushing through their notion of liberal revolution, while, as they thought necessary, of course, using pretty authoritarian methods, sometimes very authoritarian methods, to crush opposition, both from the right in the form of Catholic conservatives, but also from the left in the form of the rising socialist movements. So for liberals to use illiberal means to defend their power, but also, of course, what they see as their ideals, is not, in fact, something so new. I mean, the thing is that for, you know, since the Second World War, they haven't really felt until recently under serious pressure, because you've had, of course, conservative parties and social democratic parties, but they've all been liberals, really, essentially. Well, now, for the first time in many decades, there are radical alternatives, and the establishments are trying to stop them.
We've got a couple of crises of really long-standing orders here. There's the domestic orders of liberal politics, parliamentary democracy, all that stuff that AFD and Donald Trump are bringing into question. And then the crisis of a post-World War II order in its entirety, the order of free trade, NATO, the whole project. Aren't Trump at all symptoms of the crises of these orders? And it's not likely that we can put them back together again.
Well, no, I don't think it is. On free trade, of course, Trump is basically tearing that up in ways which leave the European Union staggering. Although, of course, the European Union itself has been pretty hypocritical about this when it comes to its own rules. You will agree with me. I mean, we both thought that the US language of a rules-based order was always pretty hypocritical. And as Peter Beinart, amongst others, you know, wrote, I mean, actually a cover for US power and EU power. But Trump has now completely torn off the mask on that. On the other hand, in a world based on power, it does seem that Trump or his people are capable of doing something that the US has not been capable of really since the end of the Cold War, which is recognizing other powers. Respect for power does mean a willingness to acknowledge other people's power and possibly, as with Russia, a willingness to accommodate it. That is not a system preferable to respect for international law and norms. But perhaps it's, in certain respects, less dangerous than a situation in which the US simply thinks that it has the right and ability to do anything, irrespective of other people's wishes, at least if other people have the power to frustrate that.
It does seem that vice has given up even trying to pay tribute to virtue.
Yes, I really think that it has. I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't know about you, but I'm beginning to feel that to some extent I've had it, like others like me, rather easy in the past, because, of course, it's been very easy to attack American policy for its hypocrisy, all the multiple ways in which America violated its own professed ideals and rules and principles. But if you now have a US administration which quite openly says, we don't have any principles, what are we going to say? It's That said, I'd just like to say, though, that the notion that the US is withdrawing from or abandoning NATO is wrong. What Trump and company are doing is that they're obviously abandoning an expansionist version of NATO, and by implication, the EU as well, since the EU was always expanding under a NATO umbrella. Trump is not going to allow any more countries into NATO or encourage them to join. I think that the US will remain committed to defending NATO within its existing borders, if only because, to quote from Orwell's 1984, NATO is airstrip one for the Americans. Ramstein Air Force Base, Naples Naval Base, are very important to the projection of US power in the Middle East and support for Israel. And there's no sign in the Trump administration that they want to abandon those agendas.
And what about the EU response? I mean, we have Keir Starmer talking about sending British troops to Ukraine, which strikes me as utterly bonkers. So is Europe going to try, or it's funny, they're not even a member of the EU, but is Europe now going to try to fill this vacuum with its own fantasies of armed might?
Well, I think fantasies is the word. I mean, we're going to have declarations, but you know, this Paris meeting yesterday broke up with no decision, not even an announcement as far as I can see. And one of the reasons was that as soon as this idea of a European force came up, the Poles, who are supposedly Ukraine's greatest allies, promptly said no, no Polish troops under any circumstances whatsoever. Scholz, the German chancellor, said, oh, it's far, far too early to discuss this. He even said it's inappropriate to discuss this at this stage. And Starmer, having made this offer or proposal, very quickly said, oh, but a US backstop is essential. Any European force has to be guaranteed by the US. Well, Hegseth, of course, had already said that that isn't going to happen. So you are getting a lot of words from Europe, but I very much doubt myself that there will be serious action from this point of view. There are two other issues. The first is European rearmament. But there, you know, it's rather interesting that Macron gave this interview to the Financial Times saying that, you know, Europe must integrate its military industries. It must collectively buy its own weapons and not buy them from America. And he gave the example of this SAMPT, I think it's air defense system, which he said was better than the American Patriots. Well, guess where the SAMP 3 is built? It's built in France, of course. But if the Germans came back and said, oh, sure, if you will agree to abandon your production of, I think they're called Leclerc tanks, and buy German Leopard tanks instead, somehow I don't think that the French government is going to agree to that.
This is what Wall Street calls talking one's book. It's
like precisely that. The other thing, of course, where the Europeans are critical is, well, on the first bit of this, they will have to be brought in, and they will be by the Americans, is the reconstruction of Ukraine. But the other is Ukrainian membership of the European Union, which, by the way, the Russians have just said, fine, no problem, we're okay with that. And of course, if that could be achieved, I mean, that would anchor Ukraine in the West far more than NATO membership. Turkey's been a member of NATO for 70 years, but I don't think it's generally regarded as part of the West anymore. But the thing is, the reason the Russians are so relaxed about this is they don't think it's ever going to happen. Latest news from the Polish border, Polish farmers and truckers who belong to what's supposed to be Ukraine's closest ally, they've been blocking the border to stop Ukrainian imports. And when it's a question of telling French farmers their subsidies go and their markets go in order to bring Ukraine into the European Union, very hard to see that happening. Maybe by then the European Union itself will have turned into something quite different and you'll have a much, much looser EU, which Ukraine could join. But the truth of the matter is that just at the moment, the EU countries aren't in a position to promise anything. Macron's already a lame duck. If you look at the polls, it seems almost certain that Le Pen will win the presidency in 2027. Germany's having elections in 5 days. AfD won't win, but it'll take months and months to stitch together a new government in order to keep AfD out.
In policy terms, AfD is going to win a lot.
Yeah, sure. But as a result, the EU cannot make credible commitments at the moment.
Samuel Moyne tweeted, "Vassal states complain that the empire is retracting," which is,
yeah,
he's got a point.
Well, I sort of, you know, Starmer's statement that Britain wants to be the interlocutor between Europe and America, it did rather make me think, you know, of a field hand aspiring to be a house servant, so that rather than receiving the master's orders, he can pass the master's orders on to the remaining field hands. But it seems that the master isn't actually interested anymore in them. You could feel sorry for the British establishment, except that, my God, they've set themselves up for this.
Well, they've been nurturing and petting affectionately this special relationship for so long that they're lost without it.
Absolutely.
You said earlier that Trump is not a fascist. Let's talk a bit more about just precisely what he is, or is that even possible to say?
It seems to me that he's much more like a Latin American caudillo, not a military leader, of course, but a populist boss, but who is supported by a bunch of planter and capitalist business oligarchs with a lot of populist language while they essentially colonize the state from within. It seems to be very much the kind of setup that the Russian oligarchs achieved in the 1990s until Putin turned up and crushed the independent oligarchs and created a new kind of oligarchy run by himself. But that seems to me the closest analogy. Because, you know, when one thinks of fascism, one thinks of highly disciplined, organized movements run very often, if you look at the Germans and the Italians and the Spanish, by ex-soldiers, you know, veterans.
With large parties behind them, too. And,
you know, with large organized parties behind them. Somebody like Elon Musk would never have been tolerated in Nazi Germany or fascist Italy. I mean, of course, capitalists helped those movements to power, but after that, they were expected to take orders from the state, not to take over the state themselves and tell it what to do.
The spectacle of Elon Musk reading our tax data and social security numbers and everything, it's just remarkable. I was trying to think of any precedent in American presidential administrations. You know, the biggest scandal one can think of is the Teapot Dome thing, which was one oil field and the equivalent of a couple of million modern dollars. It's just nothing, no precedent for this sort of thing, as far as I can tell. What exactly is going on with Musk inserting himself into the highest levels of power?
This is partly technology. I mean, maybe if Andrew Carnegie and Frick and Pierpont Morgan and Company at the end of the 19th century had electronic access to government records and had the internet, maybe they would have done something like this, because they were certainly convinced that the state was to be run for their benefit. And they were not shy about using, you know, organs of the state, the police, the National Guard, even the army, to crush strikers, for example, in the name of the free market. Oligarchy is not alien to the US tradition. It's just we haven't seen anything quite like this for, really since Teddy Roosevelt, I think. Something like the Gilded Age, perhaps. This is something that Boris Berezovsky and Khodorkovsky and company would have wanted to create in Russia in the 1990s, except that Russia then was such a mess that they did get hold of the state, but in the process they crumbled the state. They helped to not destroy it, but really gravely weaken it. Now that, of course, could happen in America as well. I saw a story this morning that Musk is trying to fire hundreds of American air safety officials. Well,
nice timing on that.
After recent crashes, if he really does that, how long before you begin to see some terrible air accidents? At which point, I think, you know, there will be a general backlash, hopefully from the American population. And unless they can, which they will probably try to do, really rig the next elections in 2028, they'll lose. If you destroy the state or cripple it in the process of taking it over, you may cut your own throats in the process, which, you know, is very much what the Russian oligarchs did in the 1990s. They did so much damage to the state that in the end, what was left of the Russian, you know, state establishment came together to insist that they be either crushed or disciplined, which is what Putin did.
given what they're dismantling, in the process of dismantling, basic stuff like what you mentioned, air safety, the Weather Bureau, just really basic functioning, the entire system of higher education, science. You don't have to be some kind of social democrat even to think that these are important functions of a central government, and they are systematically dismantling them to a point where it's hard to see the U.S. can go on as a functioning society if this is allowed to continue unchecked.
Well, certainly as a successful society competing with China in technology. And yes, I mean, the U.S. will continue to stagger on, but it will be increasingly dysfunctional, even more unequal, even poorer, with even less, you know, of a technological base outside the military. But of course, one of the reasons why Musk is saving, I mean, frankly, peanuts on all these programs like air safety, and is that so far, well, nobody, of course, dares touch the US military. Although, who knows? I mean, Trump and company have surprised us so much, maybe they will even do that. But so far, no sign of that. But above all, of course, the big thing is Social Security and Medicare. That is by far the biggest outlay, apart from the military, and of course, debt, which they can't do anything about because they won't raise taxes. Well, I mean, if Musk sets about really cutting Social Security and Medicare to the American middle classes and the elderly, I mean, it's, I mean, the Democrats would have to be, totally, totally useless not to win in 2028.
Well, if anybody could live down to that, it's the Democrats.
Well, yes. I mean, they've certainly done their best.
That was Anatole Levin, director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Where'd You Go, new from Horse Girl. Next is Trump a neoliberal. What would make him one or not one? Does it matter? And where do Musk and Doge come from? To address those questions, we're joined by Quinn Slobodian. Among other things, Quinn, whose day job is as a professor of history at Boston University, wrote the book on neoliberalism, which he discussed in his debut appearance on this show back in 2019, Globalists, the End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism. More recently, he wrote about the techno-libertarian right's dream of establishing autonomous zones, insulated from democracy, where they can run things according to their own views of freedom and profit maximization. That was in his book, Crack Up Capitalism. Both those texts are appropriate background for figuring out what the hell is going on these days. He also has a piece on the New York Review of Books website, Speed Up the Breakdown, that examines three major strands of the Trump regime, Doge Branch. Quinn Slobodian. Intellectuals love to classify things, so maybe this is just the obsession of an intellectual, but is Trump a neoliberal? Does the question even matter? Is this the taxonomic passion at work, or does the question have some political significance?
From the academic side, it does matter because this is how we order the world. And I think also it helps us to sort of try to discern some deeper motivation behind what can seem like a chaotic and arbitrary form of rule. When I ask the question about neoliberalism, I find it helpful to think about it historically. So, you know, where did neoliberalism come from in the first place? Well, it was people in the 1930s who were worried about collectivists on the right and the left. They were worried about fascists, and they're worried about socialists and communists. And both of those people were a threat to economic freedom. They're a threat to capital security, and they're a threat to the international division of labor. So neoliberals, you know, coined themselves to demarcate themselves from 19th century liberals and figure out how in an era of mass democracy and ending empire, you could still have an interconnected world where capital was free to move, goods were free to move, and sometimes people were free to move. We can think about the 20th century as a long project to build an institutional apparatus in which capital rights had more rights than citizens, free trade was institutionally locked in, and investors often had the rights to do things like sue countries. That version of neoliberal globalism, protected through multilateral institutions like the World Trade Organization and so on, looks at the moment to be in its death throes. So I think you can say that the long neoliberal institutional project is suffering, taking body blows, and Trump has been one of the main people to deliver those body blows. So the question is, you know, what is it now that he represents? You can have capitalism without neoliberalism. State capitalism is a recognized form. Autocratic capitalism rules in places like Saudi Arabia and China to a lesser extent. So I think what we're seeing is a move from this model of neoliberal globalism to a form of autocratic capitalism, which preserves some forms of protection for capital rights, but not always placing them underneath the kind of arbitrary decisions of increasingly centralized authoritarian leadership.
You said the free movement of people, sort of. It's interesting that this gang of anti-neoliberals, you know, whether we're talking about Orban or Trump or whatever, they're all really opposed to immigration. Why do you think they're so energized by the free movement of people?
And this is something I talk about in my book, Hayek's Bastards, that's coming out in a couple months, and I think it can be misunderstood. So I give the example of Peter Brimelow, who I've spoken about on this show before. You can look at immigration questions through an economic lens, and when you do that, you realize that they aren't really opposed to immigration as such. They're just applying economic parameters to the question of immigration. And they see that there's a purpose in sort of condemning and vilifying certain kinds of migrants while turning a blind eye to others. The way that the H-1B controversy in the MAGA camp over the winter holidays was resolved, I think, was basically Trump, by his silence, suggesting that MAGA is going to have it both ways. I think they are going to continue to be able to bring in the high-skilled H-1B type temporary workers that Silicon Valley needs, while still doing some sort of sadistic border theater and roundup, putting people in planes that are actually not optimal for transporting people out of the country. That's a spectacular act that often doesn't have a lot to do with the underlying sort of economic framework. And someone like Orban is similar, right? He's happy with certain kinds of people and not others. So I think it, more often than not, is something that is played for the masses, but underneath it, there is a kind of economic logic that still dominates.
What would that economic logic be? I mean, people who claim that the Republican Party is now the party of the workers say that it's going to raise wages at the low end to restrict immigration. There's not a whole lot of evidence that that's going to happen, but what economic logic are you thinking of here?
That position in general, the idea of the Republican Party as the new party of the workers and the sort of national conservatism push, has been so far shunted to the side in the present practice of government in MAGA that I don't really think it's worth that much serious reflection. I think it was always a kind of a snow job for the voters. What I said still stands. There were high rates of deportation under Biden and Obama. There were slightly higher rates under Trump 1. And it'll probably be something similar where they do things for the cameras. And then meanwhile, the usual hierarchical model of exploitation that exists in this country, where people without rights are squeezed for maximum productivity, continues to make the country operate. I don't see so far that there's some fundamental break with the dual labor model that America has relied on for decades already.
We've been hearing about zombie neoliberalism ever since the 2008 financial crisis. Is there any coherent model that's taking the place of this thing? Say what you want about neoliberalism. It was a coherent model.
One way for me to figure out the category question is when you look beyond the borders of the United States. One of the things I've talked about that the neoliberals talked about was that the world should be thought of as being a space of both dominium, a kind of space of property and goods and capital, and a space of imperium, or like governments and states and people. The role of states is to let the goods flow. The states create a framework, legal predictability, a reliable set of forms of repercussions and arbitration. And that is what kind of neoliberal globalism was. states had a role, which the role is to facilitate the extension and expansion of markets globally and to protect some version of open competition. When Trump says something like, I am going to seize the Panama Canal or annex Greenland, that is a real overstep of this idea of states' roles being to stand back and create predictability. It looks like a real tilt where old style 19th century models of gunboat diplomacy and outright annexation displace like the whole 20th century model, which is like, sure, we can have states, but in the end, what matters is economic activity and economic competition. And the fact that we're going back to this states first, markets second model, or states act as battering rams to open up markets for openly clientelistic partners of the regime, which is what we have now, right? I mean, the tariff threat is not being used to seal off America and make it autarkic and self-sufficient. It's being used to crack open recalcitrant markets for the goods of Trump's close funding partners. Use the tariffs to get X and Starlink into EU, to get Palantir and Anduril into the EU. Use it maybe to crack open parts of the Chinese market. So there's a weaponization of economic tools that to me is no longer helpfully described as neoliberal. And it's something I think we're still scrambling to find a name for. People like Henry Farrell and Abe Newman are writing about weaponized interdependence in ways that I think is helpful as well. But I think the core thing that we need to keep in mind is none of this is a real departure from the sort of bottom line imperative of profit maximization and accumulation under capitalism. It's just happening now with a different relationship to state power.
It's remarkable to see some capitalists shrugging their shoulders at tariffs. You would think that that would be like denying the virgin birth if you're a Catholic. Yet they seem not too exercised by what Trump is doing, breaking up this world trading system, which has been very, very good to our capitalist class so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things to say about that, both of which are about historical precedent. One is if you look at the Reagan years, and people would often think of Reagan as the hero of neoliberalism, the U.S. used very aggressive trade policy against Japan to get its semiconductors into the market, to close off its own market from Japanese automobiles. People call this competitive liberalization, but it was a kind of protectionism which was being used for market ends. That itself is already there. You don't need to do this all through like a World Economic Court in Geneva. A lot of the Republicans in the Dole camp were actually pretty suspicious of the United States, you know, ceding any level of its sovereignty to something like a WTO. So you don't have to use multilateralism to do aggressive American economic policy. And tariffs, you know, we've been here before in 2017. You read the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal in 2017. It was like five alarm fire, like DEFCON 3, like the whole world economy is going to come apart at its seams because America is introducing steel and aluminum tariffs against, you know, its close trading partners. And the market kind of shrugged. Consumers kind of shrugged. It turned out there was actually a lot more give and a lot more resilience in the world economic trading system than people thought. People just moved factories from China to Vietnam. They moved things into Mexico. They shuffled around supply chains in ways that dodged the tariff threat. And ultimately, the bottom line effect on profits and even consumer prices was kind of negligible. For me, it was totally reasonable that the markets again shrugged in the face of the latest tariff stuff, because it actually, especially vis-a-vis China, has ended up being a lot less extreme than what had been threatened in the campaign. I mean, recall Trump saying he was going to put 1,000% tariffs on China. That hasn't materialized. And it hasn't materialized in part, I think, because of the Silicon Valley bear hug. I mean, I still think that Musk and Andreessen and co. were as motivated by anything as just throwing their bodies in front of the bullets of this potential China policy by keeping their relationships to what is an extremely important market and site of production for Musk. I mean, he made almost 1 million Teslas in China last year. It's his second biggest market. We need to see how the slaps at Canada and Mexico are being used, I think, less in pursuit of some kind of economic policy as more just forms of bullying, right? A way of showing that there will be no rationality and you need to just bend the knee or you're going to experience unpredictability and chaos and that will have domestic political consequences.
Alan Beatty of the Financial Times said of Trump's trade policy, it's mercantilism laced with narcissism and caprice. which is a nice phrase. Is he some sort of mercantilist? Is this like a revival of really, really old school economics?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I like Alan Beatty, but he is a pure free trade thinker in a way. And in, because he is, he relies on this false binary between free trade on one side and mercantilism on the other, which of course goes back to like the age of empire, merchant empires, 18th century, 19th century. Mercantilism was a real system which formally and legally made it illegal to trade with another empire. You could not, you may not. When liberal free traders have revived the language of mercantilism and protectionism in the 20th century and the 21st, they've done so to imply that it's either or. You either have to have completely multilaterally regulated open free trade, or else you're effectively going back to the era of, you know, the Spanish and British Empire. But actually, there is a lot of space in between. You can use tariffs for reasons other than just intimidating your neighbors. You can use tariffs to try to encourage infant industries that are still needing to be protected from foreign competitors. You can do it to aim your production towards more green ends. You can use it as the Europeans are doing with a carbon border adjustment tax to reward importers who use less carbon intensive forms of manufacturing. So I think that it's really important in criticizing, for good reason, the way that Trump is using tariffs, to not assume that therefore there's only one other possibility to avoid a relapse into the dark ages, which is to get back to the golden age of the late 90s and early 2000s. I mean, we got here for a reason. We got here because the Financial Times commentators of the world helped us to grease the slide down to a track that hit a big viper's nest in 2016, and we're still struggling to get out of it. So we need to be more creative than just rely, I think, on these old binaries and hollow nostalgia.
I'm speaking with the historian Quinn Slobodian. I'm speaking with Anatole Levin, director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute. Well, it would be nice if the tariffs were tied to some sort of industrial policy. It just seems whimsical in a lot of cases here.
Again, we've been in this cycle already. So 2016, Bernie Sanders had a grounded criticism of the globalization of the late 90s. His campaign was strangled in its crib by the DNC. The smart strategist of Trump's team, namely Steve Bannon, pickpocketed this language of critique of deindustrialization and Chinese competition and handed it to Trump. Trump had no idea what to do with it. He didn't have any thoughts either way about these, except that he somehow thought that America was being exploited and laughed at some basic level. And so we got, you know, a pretty chaotic and feckless trade policy through Trump 1. Enter Trump 2, there was some sense behind the trade policy. You had people who took that opening, that shattering of the consensus around free trade globalism, and then tried to do something interesting with it. They failed for a number of reasons. But then when they failed and Trump came back in, we're back to just, you know, bull in a china shop and, you know, bullying for its own sake. Being in a time of indeterminacy is often disorienting and produces sometimes unpleasant and even destructive results. But in the big picture, like looking at this as a historian over the last 50 or 60 years, we should actually also be a little bit exhilarated by the fact that common sense is in disarray. There is a space for rethinking what it is exactly that a state is for, what it is a state should do vis-a-vis the rights of its citizens and the rights of corporations. Our task, I think, you know, as the left is to like give some semblance of order to what is an anarchic and ultimately nihilistic economic policy on the part of the Trump administration.
And meanwhile, you've got Trump quoting, whether apocryphal or not, Napoleon on someone who saves his country is breaking no laws, which sounds like dictatorial, frankly.
Well, that one is interesting because J.D. Vance, to me, at least kind of famously, before he was made vice president, said that he thought that the left had all been reading Carl Schmitt and had decided that there was nothing more important than just to gain power. Schmitt, the 1930s Nazi jurist, who famously said that the right of the sovereign is to determine the exception, to sort of say, like, sometimes the law doesn't apply if you're the sovereign. He's relevant to the neoliberal question because neoliberals kind of agreed with Schmitt. They thought sometimes the state needs to stand above special interests and say, you know, capital rights are more important, competition is more important, free market is more important. So you can crush the unions, you can restrain democracy at certain times. You know, the Pinochet model of authoritarian capitalism. if you look and squint, you could see that part of what Trump is doing is similar, is using the sovereign exception to protect the health in strong quotation marks of the current model of asset inflation driven, tech hype accelerated, exploitation reliant, mostly IP monopoly dependent techno-feudalism that we currently operate on as a country. His Schmittianism is something more than just Schmitt for the market. It is also Napoleonic, as you say. It is puts the state above the interests in the end of economic competition or even profit and capital. And it becomes a personalization of power for its own sake that I think we're all just trying to get our heads around now.
Well, it's turning out to be rather lucrative for Musk himself and the cronies.
Yeah, I mean, I think this one is fascinating because the whole principle of Silicon Valley Californian ideology was that the old concentrations of power around big companies like General Motors, Lockheed Martin, and their like cozy relationship to Washington was leading to sclerosis and lack of innovation. And the good thing about people just making startups in their garages in California is that there was a different ethos. Fail again, fail harder. There's like this whole ecology of new ideas that would blossom and then die. And there's a sort of idea of Cambrian explosion of new processes and products. It was a self-congratulatory mythology, but also there was something to that. They always did rely on huge defense contracts, and the U.S. state was always there in the background. But there was, at least in their own narration, something happening there, you know, incubation of all these different ideas. But now in their victory, they've trampled all over their own mythology, because the idea now of just bolting on Musk's six companies to the U.S. defense budget, bolting on Thiel's companies that he founded onto the U.S. defense state, is actually like undermining the whole idea that you have disruptive competition and innovation, and that's where you get the good things, quote unquote, of American capitalism. So there is, I think, a narration here of them being kind of victims of their own success, and that techno-authoritarianism is actually undermining the techno-utopianism that they once claimed to represent.
In your New York Review piece, you identify three parts to this the Muskian project. It almost seems like Trump is an afterthought in some of these things, and like Musk is really the star of the show. But anyway, the Wall Street Silicon Valley nexus of distressed debt and startup culture, anti-New Deal conservative think tanks, and the extremely online world of anarcho-capitalism and right-wing accelerationism. Let's talk about those things in turn. What does this Wall Street Silicon Valley nexus want out of the state?
Well, I think this is the usual one when people would, you know, without having the sort of 1930s intellectual history, if someone just said, what is neoliberalism? You'd probably say, well, it's trying to treat the government like a corporation. The bottom line governs everything. You need to cut costs and, you know, trim the fat, and people suffer as a result, but you get higher productivity and higher profits. That is an idea that someone like Vivek Ramaswamy represents for sure, but also a Paul Ryan, also a Bill Clinton, also an Obama, an idea of transforming the state into being more responsive to market signals. So that's the version of the Doge project that made some people, including people who are now quite appalled by what Musk is doing, quite interested in the idea of getting in and trimming the fat and streamlining the bureaucracy. That is itself has its more extreme manifestations in the private equity firms that go in and buy rest homes and strip them down to the bones and either operate them on a shoestring or sell on the fixed assets for whatever they can. So there is a vulture capitalist angle to this, which is well represented in Trump's cabinet the first time. His commerce secretary was also called the king of bankruptcy, Wilbur Ross, and is well represented in his current cabinet, which includes people who have made their fortunes in private equity, including big ones like Cerberus and other smaller ones in real estate. So that's the still gruesome, but maybe familiar face of distressed debt, asset stripping, Wall Street, also Silicon Valley startup culture, which is about doing what Musk did at Twitter, go in and fire 75 to 80% of the employees, you know, keep the thing running buggy, but more profitable theoretically. Of course, the value of the company is plummeted. But that idea of ruthless managerialism is hardcore, but we know it. The second one I talk about in the piece is the more conservative opposition to the idea of the administrative state as a kind of monster that has grown out of the post-1960s civil rights movement and Great Society with the New Deal before that. The idea there is that the state is a kind of a leviathan, which has been constructed to transfer funds from makers to takers. So take money from the hardworking entrepreneurial taxpayer and give them to special interests, especially racial minorities, underrepresented groups, and, you know, the undeserving poor. So that's another strain of conservative thought, well represented by the dozens of think tanks that came together to write the Project 2025 omnibus set of spec policy ideas. And that's also there in DOGE. You're not just attacking the state as such or just finding the most efficient parts of it and emphasizing them, but you're going after things that have to do with, as you see it, progressive issues of morality that are better left to the family or need to be regulated from above, like around abortion rights. So that idea of deconstructing the administrative state doesn't really have like a commercial ethos at its heart. It is more of a Christian patriarchal defense of white supremacy, I would say, that animates people like Russell Vought, who's the head of the Office for the Management of the Budget. The third strain, which I think is more unfamiliar to us from the history of conservatism in the United States, is so-called right-wing accelerationist or even anarcho-capitalist streak. Now, this is associated with people like Curtis Yarvin and Nick Land. Curtis Yarvin, sometimes discussed as the dark prince, sort of animating supposedly the Silicon Valley tech right, sometimes exaggerated, but also, as he himself says, he is contributed to the kind of online soup that many of the young staffers in the GOP world swim around in. So the fact that one of these DOGE staffers just came out and said he's doing what he's doing because he read Ron Unz, who's like, you know, one of these classic Silicon Valley-based race science curious edgelord libertarians, suggests that there's also something weirder than just Heritage Foundation and Carlyle Group or Cerberus happening here. And that, I think, has to do with a vision of not just constraining the state, but doing away with it altogether. So shattering the central government to leave in its place the kind of things that Yarvin describes in his work over the last, you know, now 20 years, where instead of one big nation, you have a patchwork, as he calls it, of competing feudal units that are both archaic in the sense that they would be modeled on things like Dubai, even monarchies, but also futuristic. So they would remain super connected to each other through whatever fiber optic cables, you know, probably, you know, vertical takeoff and landing taxis.
It's Starlink, of course, Starlink.
Starlink steps in right there because you don't have to worry about things being severed on the ground. And that's, you know, obviously significant now. Underwater cables have become a target for sabotage more and more. If you can get things from the sky, the problem is solved. But his vision, you know, to sum it up would be like Europe in the year 1000, where you've got like this totally messy mosaic of polities, you know, all these funny little duchies and self-governing sort of outposts. So it looks politically like a total mess. But then there's a commercial network that links all these things. So there are merchants who travel between. There is a kind of a division of labor. So you have this model of separate but global, where things are politically fortified enclaves on the one hand, but then remain sort of plugged into a global international division of labor on the other. And that's like a vision of the world that's pretty extreme and foreign to most people's way of thinking, except from maybe some science fiction. But it's one that is the new strain that's sort of merging into those other more familiar, the DOGE attack the state mentality.
And quite frankly, anti-democratic.
Oh, absolutely. Without embarrassment. The premise of it is that democracy has produced, you know, completely suboptimum outcomes. We should model governance on corporate governance, not one person, one vote, but amount of wealth equals the amount of votes, which is a 19th century model of corporatism and privilege. And that should be translated into a new way of doing kind of CEO monarchs rather than elected representatives for the head of state. There's an interesting early 21st century context, which is around the invasion of Iraq. So Yarvin is really getting going with these dark enlightenment theories around 2008-09 at a time when, you know, the US has already invaded Afghanistan and Iraq has been occupying it for some time. And it's not going well, as we all know. But what is Iraq? I mean, it was, on the one hand, a kind of a laboratory of empire by contractor. So for the first time, you know, you have as many contract private employees there as you do armed forces. And it was also this sort of parodic attempt to introduce democracy without popular support for the people rolling out democracy. So the famous, like, fingers with the ink on them, you know, was supposed to mark some victory of the neoconservative transformative project. Obviously, it was a total joke. Worse than a joke, it was, you know, a site of, you know, mass death and political collapse. And Yarvin was looking at that and comparing it to Dubai at the same time, which partially because of the Iraq war was experiencing this economic vertical rise. It was the staging ground and kind of deployment spot for the American fleet heading to the Gulf, but also because they didn't bother with this whole democracy idea. You have like a sort of clan-based, hyper-centralized rule. Most of the people who live in Dubai are not citizens. Most of them can be fired and deported at any moment. A good chunk of them are hardly being paid at all. They have zero recourse, no rights. And for Yarvin, this looked like, instead of a dystopian thing, like kind of a template for a more efficient form of future politics. I still think that if we want to understand Trump's mentality such as it exists, it's more helpful to look not at 1930s Italy or Germany, but 21st century Saudi Arabia and Emirates, Abu Dhabi and Dubai. I think that's the model of capitalism that he's trying to displace neoliberalism with. And we're still searching for a name for it, I suppose.
That was Quinn Slobodian, professor of history at BU. He's got a book coming out in April called Hayek's Bastards, Race, Gold, IQ, and the Capitalism of the Far Right. And he'll be on the show to discuss it. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this. Some of Leadbelly's song, The Scottsboro Boys, recorded in 1938 from the Smithsonian Folkways collection. His remarks at the end, edited for length, advising black people to be careful about traveling to Alabama, where the 8 teenagers who were wrongly accused of rape, include what may be the first usage of woke in its now incendiary sense. Till next week, bye.
Don't you know it's hard to make nobody in Alabama ring? Woody Alabama, and you better watch out. The landlord will get you gonna jump in the shower. Scottsboro Boys, Scottsboro Boys, hey, what's it all about? Woody Alabama, and you better watch out. The landlord will get you gonna jump in the shower. Scottsboro Boys, Scottsboro Boys, hey, what's it all about? I'm gonna tell all the colored people they've been on Sugar Hill. Don't you know we're good in Alabama to try to live? Woody Alabama, and you better watch out.
And the lawyer what got him out, I know him pretty good. I've met him. And he showed me the Scottsboro Boys, and I shake hands with him, so I made this little song about down there. So I advise everybody to be a little careful when they go along through that, but stay woke, keep their eyes open.